This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, September 21st, 2020, the last night of summer. Autumn arrives around 8:30 tomorrow morning. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on tonight's show, adolescent John Harrington would play in a cardboard refrigerator box and pretend he was an astronaut. Adult John Harrington flew in space and worked on the International Space Station. He was the first enrolled member of a Native American tribe to fly in space. Early next month, he'll participate in a conversation hosted by the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville. We reached him at his home in Montana on Friday, and part of our conversation on tonight's show. Arkansas's number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 is increasing by nearly 600. Today's report from the Arkansas Department of Health includes 596 confirmed cases and 20 positive antigen test results. 15 deaths have been added to the state's fatalities from the virus. Pulaski County is reporting the most new cases, 56. Benton County has 39 new cases and Washington County, 29. There are just more than 6,700 active cases in the state. People hospitalized from the disease increased by 35 in the most recent 24 hours. There are now 447 Arkansans in state hospitals because of complications from COVID-19. Governor Asa Hutchinson will host a briefing tomorrow about Arkansas and COVID-19. Today, he wrote on Twitter that during that briefing tomorrow, he plans to discuss preparations for winter and the latest White House report on the virus. Arkansas's senior U.S. senator says there is no room to dispute the constitutional authority the president has to nominate a person to fill the Supreme Court vacancy left by Justice Ruth Ginsburg's death. Senator John Bozeman issued a statement this afternoon that, historically, in a presidential year when the president and Senate represent the same political party, a new justice has been nominated and confirmed. 4 years ago, when Democratic President Barack Obama nominated Merrick Garland for the High Court, the GOP majority in the Senate did not bring that nominee to the floor for a vote. Talk Business and Politics reports Walmart continues to work on a final agreement to purchase a 7.5% stake in TikTok Global. The video sharing platform's parent company, ByteDance, continues efforts to resolve issues the Trump administration has highlighted as possible reasons to ban its presence in the United States. And members of the University of Arkansas community, students, faculty, and staff, can take part in a drive-through flu vaccine clinic later this week. The Pat Walker Health Center will stage the event in the parking lot across from Baum Walker Baseball Stadium on Razorback Road Wednesday from noon to 4. Since the clinic is for university students, staff, and faculty only, participants will need to show their university ID. Cost for the vaccine is $20 for students, $50 for faculty and staff, though most health insurance policies cover 100% of the vaccine cost. This is Ozarks at Large. The number of Arkansans receiving opioid prescriptions is decreasing, while the number of individuals receiving prescriptions for the opioid overdose reversal medication naloxone is increasing. That's according to a new data brief from the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more on how these numbers reflect the effectiveness of policies designed to combat the opioid epidemic in the natural state.
Approximately 111,000 fewer Arkansans had an opioid prescription in fiscal year 2019 than in fiscal year 2017. During that same two-year time period, the number of individuals with a naloxone prescription increased from 81 to nearly 3,000. Craig Wilson, Director of Health Policy at the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement, says this is a good sign.
It's really good. It's really good because you have a kind of preventive action on the front end, but there will nonetheless be individuals who need high dose opioid prescriptions, and will use them. According to the schedule, you'll have individuals who use them in inappropriate ways. And what you want to do is on the treatment end, at least anticipate those things. And for those people who are at high risk and have high dose opioids, you want to be able to offer them something that, in case there is something that goes awry, and they have an overdose, that can be corrected promptly.
In Arkansas, there have been efforts to provide naloxone to first responders and law enforcement officers, and licensed pharmacists became authorized to order, dispense, and administer naloxone to individuals without a prescription under the Naloxone Standing Protocol in 2017.
Additional flexibility for pharmacists to be able to, you know, to catch it when they've got a patient in front of them and educate them and offer them a naloxone prescription. That's been very beneficial. And you can see from our report that a lot of the prescriptions were authorized under a state protocol that was enacted in 2017. So our pharmacists have been a stopgap measure to be able to offer that for folks who are at high risk.
According to the report, about 36% of naloxone prescriptions in fiscal year 2019 were authorized by pharmacists.
In a lot of other states, there are laws in place that actually require clinicians to prescribe if they have a certain dosage of opioids that they're required to prescribe naloxone along with that. We haven't gotten to that point in our policy efforts, and I think this information is a key part of the decision process to see whether or not additional public health efforts and policy efforts are needed to move along the incentive path to offer naloxone.
The Centers for Disease Control reports, as of 2018, Arkansas has the second highest opioid prescribing rate in the country, just behind Alabama. In the natural state, 93.5 opioid prescriptions are dispensed per 100 people. To gain insight into trends in naloxone prescriptions, the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement used data from the Arkansas All-Payer Claims Database, which is part of the Arkansas Healthcare Transparency Initiative. Wilson says this database can provide a more up-to-date look at patterns in the state because national data is often delayed.
Now we're looking at 2018 data. It's now 2020. So the All-Payer Claims Database can really provide a more real-time assessment of whether or not the policies are effective.
Craig Wilson, Director of Health Policy at the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement, says they collaborated with the state's drug czar on this report and will continue to work with him to see whether or not additional steps need to be taken to curb the opioid epidemic in Arkansas.
We're continuing also to look at not just the prescription rates. I mean, we're still clearly, we're second in the nation on prescription rates, and we're well above the national average. So if we don't see significant declines that we should be seeing, I think we'll have to take some additional steps. And we've seen in some other states that there can be additional steps taken, you know, pharmacy lock-in programs, you know, increasing doctor shopping penalties, things like that.
More information on the report is available at achi.net. We'll also post a link to the report on our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. This is the first night of the 2020 September on-air fundraiser for 91.3 KUAF. Usually, this is about the time during an evening edition of Ozarks at Large, I say, well, we've sent the phone volunteers home, but you can still make a contribution online. Well, it's 2020, so we don't have any phone volunteers in the building at all this week. We're doing it all online at supportkuaf.com. So if you haven't contributed yet in September, you can do so right now at supportkuaf.com. And during the on-air fundraiser this week, if you give during Ozarks at Large, and that includes the 7 o'clock edition here, you could win the entire list of books recommended by Raven Cook, who is the host of Reflections in Black, heard each Wednesday on Ozarks at Large. We've partnered with the Dixon Street Bookstore. They have the entire list of Raven's picks for learning more about Black history in America, waiting for the winner at their location in Fayetteville. Titles that Raven told us about this summer included Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, Tears We Cannot Stop by Michael Eric Dyson, and Toni Morrison's The Origin of Others. If you've already supported the station this month or would like to enter this giveaway without giving, you can send an email to member@kuaf.com to be entered. We will draw for a winner of Raven's Reading List books during our noon show on Friday. You can support Reflections in Black and all your favorite moments on Ozarks at Large by giving a gift right now. safely, securely, in the amount of your choosing at supportkuaf.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Thank you very much for your contributions during this fundraising month, contributions that go toward making public radio, KUAF, and Ozarks at Large continue. You can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com. Early next month, the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville will host the 4th annual Native American Cultural Celebration. It will be, that V word, virtual. But the lineup of live and recorded workshops and discussions is impressive and includes a conversation with Commander John Harrington, the first enrolled member of a Native American tribe to fly in space. He was a mission specialist for the 16th Space Shuttle mission in 2002. Harrington was born in eastern Oklahoma, but his family moved away when he was young. On Friday, we reached him at his home in Montana as smoke from the western United States wildfires had reached his house. During our conversation, he mentioned that when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, he was 9 years old, and he watched the event with his family. And though as a child he played in a refrigerator box that was his imagined spaceship, he says his journey to space was not a straight line.
My first year in college, I learned how to rock climb. I met two guys out at the Garden of the Gods outside of Colorado Springs, and I would go out there because I liked the sensation of being outside. I liked being in the mountains, and I liked to scramble on the rocks. But I met two guys one day that actually had a rope on, and they were actually climbing a pretty steep climb, and I just was fascinated. And they said, you want to learn? One guy leaned over and said, hey, do you want to learn? I said, I'd love to. So we started climbing, and then I was so fascinated by it. I wanted to do it. And, of course, I would spend my time out there, not in the classroom, and or not studying to the best extent possible, and was suspended for low grades. Had a 1.72 GPA. I got 3 D's in 2 semesters, and the school decided I wasn't worthy. It's like I got kicked out of the University of Colorado when I was a freshman for a 1.72 GPA. Yep. And but the job I had, I mean, the rock climbing I did, I was offered a job in the mountains of Colorado at Interstate 70, because I knew how to climb. They needed people that could handle ropes and rappel off the side of cliffs in Glenwood Canyon, because they were surveying to put in a 4-lane highway. And they just needed guys. I knew a guy that was a rock climber. He offered me the job, and I quit in a heartbeat. I was working in a restaurant, said enough of this, and I drove to Glenwood Springs, Colorado in September of 1977. And started working on a highway with a bunch of folks that use math in their everyday life. I got to watch people actually do math and not just look at it in a textbook. That was pretty cool.
There's a couple of lessons here, right? I mean, it would have been easy with a 1.72 GPA and suspended from university to convince yourself you couldn't do other things, let alone eventually end up walking in space. I don't want to jump ahead, but it kind of shows that the final chapter hasn't been written when you might think it has been.
Oh, that's very true. I think one of the challenges we all have is what motivates us. You know, what's that thing we're going to find in life that really sparks a fire in you? And for me, it was this physical sensation and this excitement of climbing led to a job that allowed me to do, you know, something along those lines. And then in the process, you see people doing something else and you start asking questions. And I think it's that natural curiosity that we have. There's something we enjoy. You're going to ask more questions about it. And this goes back to, you know, much later in life, I work on my PhD. There's a guy named John Dewey back in the 1930s, was an educator who he found that kids were interested in those things that were most pertinent to their lives. And the idea, he started a workshop, an educational workshop in Chicago, I believe, to get kids, you know, to the motivation to get kids to learn. He was doing this back in the 30s, and it's very applicable today. And so in my PhD work, I was looking at the same thing. What motivates a child to want to study math and science? You know, what can you put in their lives that makes a difference to increase their curiosity? And that certainly is what happened for me. But it's just not that. There's a lot of other things that went around. people, you know, mentors, people that that take you aside and say, hey, what are you going to do when you grow up? You know, you can't do this the rest of your life. And that happened to me when I was surveying. The guy that owned the company sat me down one day and just out of the blue and said, hey, what do you do when you grow up? You know, it was like every other kid that was 19. I thought I was grown up. I thought, I want to do this. This is fun. I said, I like this. He goes, well, you know, you can't make a living on $4 an hour. You know, what are you doing when you're 25? What are you when you're 30? This is not going to provide you a, you know, substantive living. So why don't you go back to school and become the engineer? Be the one responsible for all this stuff. Don't just accept being, you know, the lowest paid guy on the rung of the ladder. You know, go back and become an engineer. Get a college education. You know, this is how you go about doing that. And it was that, you know, that short period of time, that small, you know, push on this little kid to make the effort to apply to go back to school. And the school actually let me back in with a 1.72 GPA. I had a motivation now, and the school gave me the opportunity. And I was fortunate because that doesn't happen very often.
When you're on the space shuttle and you arrive at the station, right? You link up. Is there a sensation? Is there a sound? What is that like? We know what it's like to land, be in a plane and land, but what is it like when you've traveled that far and you've made that successful connection?
Well, this is a process. It's like you don't just get there, obviously.
Right.
There's a process. And there's a point where you look out the window and you see this really bright star. And you realize that star is, you're going to that star. You're going to that bright object in the sky because you're reflecting the sunlight. And you go, and it gets bigger. And then it gets bigger. Pretty soon, you know, you're underneath it, flying up in front of it. And we're working on computers. I'm setting up the computers. They're all set up. The commander's flying the vehicle. We're shooting a laser rangefinder out the window to measure how fast we're closing in on it. And that star is now this incredible engineering facility in the vacuum of space. And you're like, wow, you know, this is, we're really here. And then when you, of course, it's really quiet. You're moving a formation at 17,500 miles an hour, but you can't tell, you know, you're doing it together. And then when you actually get, the vehicle gets really close, it's out the window, and you're getting ready to dock with the docking mechanism, and you hit it, you know, the whole thing kind of shudders, you know, and you can hear the little jets when the commander's firing and flying the vehicle into it. You actually feel the jets. They kind of shudder through the structure. Mm. And then when you connect, you're like, okay, but you can't just go, that's really cool. You got work to do. You got to retract the mechanism. You got to seal the mechanism. You got to do a leak check on the mechanism. You got to do all these things, because if you don't do all those things and you open the hatch, well, you know, a good day turns to a really bad day really quick.
Right.
And so you have this process that you have to work through. And so you have to look at it in amazement and go, wow, get back to work. You know, it's like the movie Vacation, you know, when Chevy Chase is in the Grand Canyon, his wife says, Clark, don't you want to look at the Grand Canyon? And Clark like nods twice and they leave, you know.
Right.
It's there, but you got to go. You got something to do.
You are in the Chickasaw Hall of Fame. You have Chickasaw heritage. You took the tribe's flag, a flute, and some other items with you in space?
Yes, sir. I flew the flag for the tribe. I gave it back to Governor Anatubby, the governor of the tribe, and then ended up also flew some eagle feathers. Mm. Eagle feather was given to me by an elder with the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, AISES, AISES, and that's a feather that was actually from the same eagle that another feather had flown to the space station on, with a guy named Ellison Onizuka. And Ellison was on the Challenger. He flew a mission, and the next mission he flew was the Challenger, so we perished on the Challenger. And I was flying a feather from that same eagle. So it was very, very, it was a very honor to have that opportunity. And so that feather now was able to actually take out and fly to photograph it, you know, over the Earth in the space shuttle. And that's now in the Smithsonian, the Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C.
Wow. When you're on a spacewalk, you did three of them that almost totaled 20 minutes. Do you hear yourself breathe in that suit, that helmet?
Oh, yeah. No, it's 20 hours, actually.
20 hours. Yeah, yeah. What did I say, 20 minutes? I meant almost 20 hours, yeah.
But, yeah. Yeah. No, it's you hear a fan. There's a fan going, and it's blowing the air over the top of your head. So you hear the mechanics of the system. But you also hear the radios. You're talking to somebody. Somebody's always listening to you. So you're just chattering away, you know, with the guy you're spacewalking with, the guy inside the vehicle, or whoever's reading the checklist, whoever's running the robotic arm. So you're communicating with somebody. It's not dead silence. It's not this, you know, the vacuum of space. You can no one here can hear you scream. they can because you're on the radio. they would hear you scream. But yeah, there's always something going on. So it's not this, you know, incredibly quiet, you know, dead silence type of thing.
You've mentioned mentors and that. Do you feel a responsibility, or I don't know if that's the right word, but the connection that you have with your heritage?
Sure.
And
you think about what your ancestors gave you the opportunity to do. You're here because your ancestors survived whatever life they were living at the time. And so if you go back and look at my tribe, my Chickasaw side of my family, you look at all the things they did in their lives that their leadership did to make sure they survived. If they hadn't made decisions, you know, at the time they did, once again, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So I look back at what my ancestors gave me the opportunity to do and the decisions they made, you know, to be successful and to survive in the moment and, you know, for generations. I'm thankful they've done that because it's given me a chance to do this. And if I can do this for somebody else, you know, then I've done what they allowed me to do. One of the things that happened, I'd say it was 2013, there was a time capsule that was buried in Oklahoma City in 1913. And one of the women that was responsible for this, getting all these artifacts together, was a Native woman, high society in Oklahoma. She was Choctaw, I think Chickasaw. Zarina was her name. I apologize, don't remember her name. But she got together a lot of artifacts, and they were not just, you know, artifacts. They were Native artifacts. There were a lot of items in this time capsule that were from tribes in Indian Territory, which became Oklahoma in 1907. So one of those things was, actually three things are really important. One was a poster that was of a fair in Oklahoma City in the late 1800s. And on that poster, it was a hand-drawn poster, and it had a bunch of Indians dancing around a fire. And in that, it was written, "Woe the poor Indian, whose untutored mind sees God in the clouds and hears him in the wind. To watch the primitive incantations of the primitive people of the forest dance around the fire, blah, blah, blah." That was this poster, late 1800s. So here was a depiction of Native people as a savage, uneducated people that were primitive. Okay, right next to that poster was a printed copy of the Chickasaw Constitution, treaties and laws of my tribe. So in that same box, there's this dichotomy of, here's the untutored Indian. Oh no, wait a minute. No, here's a printed copy of their constitution and their laws. So to me, that was an incredible moment in my life to see, hey, here's one view of what Native people were, and here's what Native people were or are today. So here was this incredible for me to be able to hold in my hand a copy of my tribe's constitution, in contrast to this, you know, primitive poster.
Right.
Well, right next to all that was a letter, was an envelope, and no one had opened it yet. And I said, "Can I open this?" I had no idea what was in it. I opened it up, and it was a letter, beautifully handwritten letter to this woman, Zarina, what her name was. "Thank you for letting me do this." And it went on that he described who he was. And his name was William Malcolm Guy. And William Malcolm Guy talked about being born in Boggy Depot, back in the day, served in the Confederate Army, was like the governor of the Chickasaw Nation. And he said it was his intent, he hopes that the representatives of living 100 years hence are in full enjoyment of the opportunity he wanted to see his people reach in terms of education and success. And I'm the first person, you know, to open this letter in 100 years, and I'm a Chickasaw citizen, and I'm an astronaut. And I'm thinking, what would he think? What would my ancestor think? The guy that wrote this letter, that the first person that picked it up to read it, in 100 years was a Chickasaw citizen who'd flown in space. And so I wrote, I actually took that copy of that, and then I gave it to Governor Anatovy. I had it printed out, and I put it in a big frame. I said, this is what leadership's all about. This is what, you know, we as leaders need to do to make a difference in the lives of our people. And here was somebody that really, that's what he wanted for his people. And like I say, his people are in enjoyment of that now, but it's because they made the decisions back then. So this is a long answer to a short question, but I think it's important that, you know, we can honor those folks that gave us the opportunity to be here by doing the most that we can.
As you and I talk, we've entered a seventh month of a global pandemic. You mentioned you're in Montana and you're getting smoke from these record-setting wildfires. It's easy to be stressed, nervous, uncertain about these times. I'm wondering, do you think since you have been up there and looked down, that you might have different perspective about the global situation than if you hadn't gone to space?
Well, I think one of the things that being in space and being in the space station, this idea that you're isolated, you know, that we, one of the things we talk about in the pandemic is, if we want to improve our chances for surviving the pandemic, you follow certain rules. You do certain things that will increase your chances of success. So astronauts, they say they take a lot of risks. Well, you know, we try and mitigate the risks that we know exist, you know, because that's what's going to allow you to survive. You know, we're like on the space shuttle or space station, there's a myriad of things that can go bad, really bad, that will, you know, will cease your existence. So we train to make sure that we can overcome those failures. We train to make sure that we can survive given certain things that happen. So if you're on the space station, you think, you know, you're in this facility that's keeping you alive. The bad stuff's on the outside. You know, the bad things are out there. If you go out there, what things will you do to decrease the risk, to mitigate the risk of you dying? Same thing being in a house or being out in public, you know. If I step out in public, science tells me that I improve my chances of not getting sick or getting somebody sick by wearing a mask. Plain and simple. It's not an idea of loss of freedom. It's an idea of what does science tell us that we need to do to make a difference in the lives of others. And if we're arrogant and insensitive enough to say it doesn't matter, well, you're not, your ancestors shouldn't have, you know, you've made it to a point where your ancestors would be really ticked off at you, you know?
Right.
And that's what I look at, is that we have a chance to make a difference if we understand the science and believe it and look at it from a global perspective, you know, a perspective of not just me, but those around me. And I think as a crew, as people on a space station or shuttle, we don't work just for us. We work for all of us on a team. Because if we didn't do that, you can't solve a lot of the problems that arise because one person cannot do it. It takes a team effort to be able to do it. So that's a perspective I have from being an astronaut or being in the Navy or being a team player, is that, you know, I have a certain responsibility, not just to me, but to those around me. And I have a certain responsibility to accept and appreciate the people that have knowledge that I do not have. Tell me what the right thing to do is. And I'm not arrogant enough to disregard that type of information because that's just not going to do me any good or anybody else any good.
Commander John Harrington was the first enrolled member of a Native American tribe to fly in space as a mission specialist for the 16th Space Shuttle mission in 2002. He will take part in a virtual conversation hosted by the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville early next month. He'll also answer 20 questions about being in space submitted by children. Deadline for submitting a question is Thursday. More details can be found at Mona.us. That's MONAH.US. We talked with him Friday by phone. He was at his home in Montana. And this is an evening edition of Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Dog Party USA, offering supervised boarding and daycare in an off-leash environment for dogs of all sizes. Dog Party follows strict vaccine requirements and COVID guidelines for a safe environment. More information is available at dogpartyusa.com.
Still to come on this Monday night edition of Ozarks at Large, our usual Monday night conversation with Randy Dixon from the Pryor Center. We'll go into the archives. Tonight's history, about a historian. Our partners, Prior Center, coming up in the last half hour of our show tonight. Speaking of partnerships, perfect time for us to continue our partnership, us being Ozarks at Large and KUAF, and you, a KUAF listener. This is the on-air fundraising week for September 2020 for 91.3 KUAF, when we take just a few minutes in between pieces, interviews, and songs to remind you that the reason we can bring you interviews, pieces, and songs from here and from around the world is because listeners just like you contribute financially to this radio station. By far, the biggest part of our budget comes from you. You pick the amount. You know best what works for you, what you can afford, and then you go to supportkuaf.com, safely, securely, make a contribution. It's that simple. It takes a couple of minutes. If you'd like to become a sustaining member and give a certain amount every month, you can do that as well. The web address is supportkuaf.com. From all of us that work at 91.3 KUAF and Ozarks at Large, thank you very much.
During the early years, in one of the early sessions of the General Assembly, the Speaker of the House of Representatives descended from the chair on one notable occasion and slew one of the members of the Assembly with a bowie knife.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone is Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Prior Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy is back with more archives to survey part of the state's past. Randy, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing pretty well. Thank you. What did we hear just then?
Well, that was John Ferguson, who was a state historian, director of the Arkansas State Archives for 45 years. I was not that familiar with him. And as I was going through the archives trying to get ideas for our segment, I came across his name, and it was cross-referenced with history, so I started to look into it. And, yeah, he was the state historian for 45 years, from 1960 to 2005. And he was at the old State House talking about an incident that occurred when the legislature used to meet at the old State House before the Capitol was built.
So what else do we have about John Ferguson?
Well, first of all, that's a portion of him speaking in 1969 about the old State House and the history. And he was interviewed by a KATV reporter by the name of Chet Locke. And here's another portion of him giving some history on the old State House.
The symbol of early Arkansas, Arkansas of the Old South, is its old State House. Dr. Ferguson, when was the old State House erected?
The old State House was begun in 1833 while Arkansas was still a territory. It was intended to serve as a territorial seat of government, but Arkansas became a state before the building was finished. It was actually not finished until 1842, but by 1836, the year of statehood, the central part of the building was near enough completed so that the legislature could use it. So it became our state capitol, our first state capitol in 1836.
That's John Ferguson, who for almost half a century was Arkansas's state historian. Do you know much more about Mr. Ferguson?
Well, yeah, he was born in near Nashville, Arkansas, and went to what's now Henderson State University, got his master's in history here up here at the U of A, and then a PhD at Tulane, and then came and ran the state archives and was the state historian. And I think he was probably or should be best known for locating and preserving newspapers. He spent a lot of time archiving and preserving history that way.
And when you say newspapers, you're not talking just the Democrat and the Gazette, but you're talking about newspapers that perhaps went further
statewide,
back.
Yes.
Right. And didn't last perhaps
right.
as long.
Right. And, you know, he was apparently had quite a remarkable memory when it came to early Arkansas history. And, you know, you could probably tell from that interview with him throwing out all those years.
Right.
That, yes, he knew the state quite well, or at least the history of it.
Well, and the state's history goes all the way back to Arkansas Post, right?
That's correct. And here's another interview with Chetlock where they are standing on the banks of the Arkansas River, and they're talking about the first and most significant settlement in the state, which was Arkansas Post.
Why did they call it Arkansas Post, Dr. Ferguson?
They called it Arkansas Post because it was a trading post. When LaSalle, under the flag of France, came down the Mississippi from Canada, he gave a grant of land along the Arkansas to one of his lieutenants named DeTotti. And DeTotti left six men to establish a post at this site to trade with the Indians, the Quapaws and the other Indians who lived in this area.
And there is no structures here now. Why is that?
Well, Arkansas Post was a place of considerable importance for a long time, though it never grew to be a very large place. While the French controlled Arkansas from the time Arkansas Post was founded in 1686 down to the 1760s, it was the center of French administration in this region. And then when Spain got control of Arkansas in 1762, it continued to be the center of administration under the Spanish.
And it was the capital of the Arkansas Territory.
It was the capital of Arkansas Territory from 1819, when we first became a separate territory, to 1821, when the capital was moved upstream to Little Rock. Now, there's no settlement here now because Arkansas Post was destroyed in a battle during the Civil War, 1863, and was never rebuilt.
John Ferguson, longtime state historian, is the focus of this visit with Randy Dixon from the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. All right, Old State House, a lot of history there. Arkansas Post, history there. And then Little Rock, but not just Little Rock, but the Little Rock.
That's right, the La Petite Roche. I know my French pronunciation is probably not good, but it was the rock that, or the, I guess you'd call it a geological formation that jutted out along the Arkansas River that the early explorers would use as a marker. And it was known as the Little Rock. And he was at a ceremony in 1969. They were making improvements to the Junction Bridge, which is right in downtown Little Rock, which is close to where the rock is. And they were making the changes because of the McClellan Kerr navigation system. And this was what first caught my attention to John Ferguson, because I just loved the way he referred to history and the history of Arkansas in this comment.
And so today we pay tribute to the people of the past who have made Arkansas, who have made us, who have given us all our advantages and disadvantages. The rock is not eternal, and neither are we. But may the rock remind us that today we are the people, and the lessons of history are in our keeping.
The Little Rock. Randy, for someone who is not a Central Arkansas native, help me out. The Junction Bridge, where is that in relation to the Big Dam Bridge? Or do I drive? Have I driven over the Junction Bridge? Do I know what that is?
Yes, No, you don't drive over it. It's the old railroad bridge.
Okay.
That's there at Riverfront Park.
Gotcha.
That's where that is. But I did talk to Tom Dillard this morning, the historian and, you know, founder of the Butler Center.
Right.
Who knew John Ferguson. And, you know, he mentioned his remarkable memory. But he said that Ferguson's legacy would probably be that he carried the flag for Arkansas history during a time when the Arkansas legislature and local communities showed little interest in preservation. So he said, you know, he did with the best he could with what he had at the time.
Interesting.
Which when he started wasn't much. He had an $18,000 budget in 1960, and when he left in 2005, it was more than $1 million. So he did build. He did build a lot for the state.
You can find out more about John Ferguson and all of the other things that we've talked about over the past few weeks at, well, just Google Pryor Center, and it will take you to the home of the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, as always, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll see you next week.
What is Titania? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. Titania is the largest moon of Uranus and the eighth largest moon overall in the solar system. Its circumference is over 270,000 miles, nearly half the size of our Earth's moon. It was discovered in 1787 by William Herschel and named after the daughter of the Titans, the primordial Greek gods, and Queen of the Fairies from A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare. But there are several key features of Titania that are absolutely amazing that I'd like to point out. First off, Titania has a nearly perfectly circular orbit around Uranus and only taking 8.7 days to complete an orbit at a speed of 8,142 miles per hour. Next, the poles of Titania spend 42 years in perpetual sunlight and 42 years in complete darkness. Titania is also very dense, suggesting that this moon may have formed from a disk of dust and debris left over after the formation of Uranus. Although being dense, the surface actually has very few impact craters. This could be due to the proposed tectonic activity on the surface, which can essentially erase and obliterate any original craters, very much like a dynamic etch-a-sketch. However, Messina Chasma is the largest canyon on Titania, spanning a whopping 927 miles from the moon's equator all the way to the South Pole. To put this in perspective, the Grand Canyon is only 277 miles long, so Mellis Chasma is just over three times longer. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is produced in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You can find more episodes at KUAF.com.
Just a few minutes before 8 o'clock and Peter Van de Graaff and great classical music that will take us all the way to the next news at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning with Morning Edition on 91.3. Before we end tonight's show, I want to remind you that if you make a contribution during this on-air fundraiser during Ozarks at Large, you will have a chance to win the 8 books recommended this summer by Raven Cook during her Reflections in Black series, heard each Wednesday on Ozarks at Large. All 8 books are at the Dixon Street Bookstore waiting for the winner to pick them up. Titles include The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, and Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. In all, 8 books. If you have already supported us during this September fundraiser, or you'd like to enter without making a contribution, you can send us an email, member@kuaf.com. We will announce the winner on our noon show on Friday. You can support Reflections in Black and all the regular features you hear on Ozarks at Large and all the regular features on 91.3 KUAF by giving a gift right now at supportkuaf.com. You decide the amount, and you would automatically be entered for the 8 books as recommended by Raven. Thanks so much for listening tonight. Thanks so much for your support over the past several years, or if it's about to be your first ever contribution, thank you for that. You can go to supportkuaf.com.
The Scott Family Amazium is hosting virtual summer camps for children ages 6 to 12 years old. Camp materials and supplies for hands-on, interactive experiences will be sent to homes 1 week prior to start. These camps are designed with activities in mind, and screen time will be limited. Amazium.org/programs for more information.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, all of Lee Creek. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Antoinette Grajeda, a contributor tonight. Timothy Dennis produced tonight's show in his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Thanks, Randy Dixon with the Pryor Center, for your help tonight. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Caitlin Ahrens. It's produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio. Thanks to Kurt Stamp, who at noon today in our afternoon session of Ozarks at Large provided a challenge that was met. Tune in tomorrow at noon, but we have another listener challenge for this on-air fundraiser. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Please get rest tonight. We'll talk to you again soon.